CNN Radio, I'm Matt Cherry. Egyptian officials say at least 12 people were killed in yesterday's clashes between Muslims and Christians outside a Cairo church. CNN's Ben Wiedemann reports the violence broke out over a Coptic Christian woman who had converted to Islam and was reportedly being held against her will.
We were near the site of one of the churches that was the center of this violence, and there were army soldiers there firing in the air, trying to keep people away from the scene.
Nearly 200 people have been arrested. The violence prompted Egypt's prime minister to call for an emergency cabinet meeting. The string of uprisings in North Africa over the winter began in Tunisia, and it's a tense day in that country's capital. Several hundred protesters have gathered in the center of Tunis, taunting riot police. Police have fired tear gas canisters into the crowd. An overnight curfew had been imposed following demonstrations against the interim government and security forces. The Mississippi River is expected to crest in Memphis Tuesday at 48 feet, just inches shy of the 1937 record. This tourist says she and her family are worried about the floodwaters.
We are very concerned because we realize it's all unpredictable. And we do not want to be stuck here in Memphis. And we don't want to have to flee in a hurry. And we want to return home safely.
Cairo, Illinois Mayor Tyrone Coleman hopes the levees protect his town.
We don't know how long they can continue to hold. You know, we're just praying.
Flooding in the Mississippi and Ohio River valleys has prompted evacuations in six states so far. Two adults and two children are dead in Los Angeles, the victims of an apparent murder-suicide. Police found their bodies after responding to a call about a shooting. The four have not been identified, and police haven't said at this point how they are related. For news anytime, go to CNN.com. This is CNN Radio.
Shopping for a home at Wells Fargo, we're with you. That's why we created the Wells Fargo Priority Buyer Pre-Approval. Come in, sit down, and talk with a Wells Fargo home mortgage consultant, and we'll let you know the mortgage loan range for which you could qualify. A Priority Buyer Pre-Approval is a great first step to help you start looking at homes within your price range. Wells Fargo. Together, we'll go far. A Priority Buyer Pre-Approval is not a commitment to lend. Please call for additional program details. Wells Fargo Home Mortgage is a division of Wells Fargo Bank, N.A., member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Where are you going?
To kill the weeds.
Whoa, don't kill the grass too, like you did last time.
Hey, wise men make mistakes. They just don't make them twice.
What's different this time?
This time, I've got Ortho Weed Begon Max. It kills weeds down to the root, but unlike other products, it doesn't kill the grass.
Ooh, so impressive.
Well, I've done it the wrong way, so I figured I might as well try it the right way.
I'm all for that.
Kill the weeds, not the grass. Get Ortho Weed Begon Max and defend what's yours.
This is Dan Tullis, and I just called
Joel Clark,
one of Select Quote Insurance Services Term Life Agents.
Hi, Mr. Tullis.
Joel, how does Select Quote save you money on term life insurance?
Well, buying term life insurance is all about choosing the right company. Let's say you take antidepressants or you smoke. All insurance companies are going to price that differently. We'll impartially shop all the companies we represent to find you the best price.
Can you give me an example?
Sure. I just got a man, 40 years old, who takes blood pressure medication, a $500,000 policy with a highly rated insurance company. His price, $21 a month.
Call 1-800-500-0351 and see how affordable term life insurance can be. That's 1-800-500-0351. 1-800-500-0351. Or go to selectquote.com. We shop, you save. Get full details on the example policy at selectquote.com/commercials. Your price could vary depending on your health, issuing company, and other factors. Not available in all states.
Why should you take krill oil and omega-3 fish oil? Well, if you are concerned about any of the following, you should absolutely be taking both. And if you qualify, we'll even give you a risk-free trial of a pharmaceutical-grade fish oil combined with the super antioxidant power of krill. But first, you have to answer yes to one of the following. Are you concerned about your joint health? What about your memory and focus? Are you concerned about your heart health? Well, if you want to increase your joint comfort by 28% in just 7 days and promote memory, focus, and heart health, we're going to give you a free bottle of Krill Omega-3 Fish Oil. Just call this toll-free number and claim yours. 1-800-900-6118. We guarantee once you try Krill Omega-3, you won't believe the difference. That's why we're going to send you a free bottle just for calling. Call now for your free bottle and start easing sore joints today. Call 1-800-900-6118. 1-800-900-6118. 1-800-900-6118.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Executive Leaders Radio. In this hour, you'll hear directly from our region's finest business leaders. Through each of the interviews, these high-achieving leaders become relatable role models who share how they were able to build their enterprise, their personal secrets of success, about leadership styles and opportunities that lie ahead. Prepare to be inspired, entertained, and to hear wisdom unheard elsewhere. Executive Leaders Radio.
You're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Mike Mannion. I'm joined by my co-hosts, Phil Horegi of Sabre Systems and Brian Biondi of League Asset Corporation. We have a fantastic lineup of guests for you today, including John Benbrook, CEO and President of MMG, Jerry Halpin, Founder, Chairman, CEO, and President of West Group Properties, Sonny Kakar, Founder, President, and CEO of Sevatech, and Dr. Norris Crone, Principal Founder, President, CEO of University Research Foundation and the Maryland Advanced Development Laboratory. But let's begin by introducing to you our first guest, a gentleman by the name of John Benbrook. John is the CEO and President of a company called MMG. Welcome, John, and what is MMG?
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here. MMG is a global patient recruitment company. We help our pharmaceutical, biotech, medical device companies help bring medicines or devices to market.
Patient recruitment, that's an interesting phrase. What exactly does that mean?
Exactly what it says. To test drugs in and to bring new medicines to market, you need to test on patients that either suffer from that indication that they're testing for. It remains the biggest barrier of drug development is getting people into those studies.
You told us a story in the green room about how it first got started. Would you tell us that story again?
Yeah, founder, her mom had been diagnosed with breast cancer, and she found it incredibly difficult to navigate through all the information that's out there on clinical trials. So there's a general awareness that was an issue. To navigate through the information was an issue. So she started the business to help patients, caregivers, and healthcare providers to navigate through the complex world of clinical trials.
Wow, talk about giving back. How big or small is MMG?
We're 100 employees. We're part of Omnicom, which is a $11 billion organization. We're much smaller than that as a part of Omnicom.
Mm-hmm. And MMG's been around for how long?
24 years.
Got it. Now, you've been the CEO and president for 5 years.
Correct.
Why did they pick you? And I know you're very professionally qualified and all of that, but peel back a few layers here. What is it that makes you special that made them pick you?
I'm still trying to figure that out. Molly started her business in the government, and our longest standing client is still NIH, the National Cancer Institute. I was brought in to help get into the commercial side of the business. I have a background in selling into pharmaceutical and biotech companies. So coming in, learning the business, it was important for me to understand where we were going as a company. I helped set that focus around continuing the clinical trial business. And as I came in and acclimated myself to the business itself and got to know what we do, I took on more and more responsibility.
But peeling back the layers, what did Molly see in you inside, deep down inside? What did she see?
I think she saw a work ethic. I think she saw leadership. I think she saw a guy that was going to come in and do what he said he was going to do. And I think that's ultimately what happened.
And where did all of those qualities come from?
I really have to tie it back to my dad. Looking at my father and looking at his work ethic, his integrity, I think I get a lot of that from him.
Tell us about your family.
We're a family of six up in New Jersey, born and raised. I'm told I put my jersey on when I speak, so hopefully it's not coming over the radio right now. I'm the oldest of four boys. Unfortunately, at 6'5", 235 pounds, I'm the runt of the family, which causes my dad said at one point he had a half a ton of sons, so it kind of gives you that perspective.
And that was a little low estimate, maybe.
It might have been, yeah.
And the biggest of the family is how big?
My brother Joey's about 6'8", and he'll probably argue with me, but he's probably pushing 300.
Wow.
So big boys. They all played football. I was the wimp that played basketball.
And maybe without stating the obvious, this required your dad to have work ethic. Why?
to feed us. He was working quite a bit. He was a electrical contractor by trade, went ahead and was working multiple jobs. So, he was out a lot. He was out quite a bit.
So it was you and three brothers. And your dad was working how many jobs, did you say?
You know, I think it was at least two, but he would moonlight as well. You know, he had side businesses. He would, construct houses and sell, turn them over. So he was constantly out looking and doing things that
to provide for his family.
Exactly right.
And what was your mom doing?
She was staying home managing the crazies. I think her favorite line, which is instilled in my brain, is take it outside. So as long as if we weren't breaking furniture, it was a chain reaction. I would hit my one brother and it would go right down the line.
John, with being the runt of the litter, but you are the oldest, correct?
Correct.
So do the three brothers acknowledge you as the leader?
I would sure like to think so, but we're a pretty competitive bunch. I think they're all leaders in their own right. One has taken over the business for my dad. He started his own business after many years working for a company. Started when he was 50 and has turned that over to my brother. My other brother, Michael, works around the clock, 7 days a week as a carpenter. My brother, Danny, was in the police officer and now is working. So I would like to think they would consider me that, but they may argue with it.
So your dad, if I heard you correctly, your dad worked for almost 30 years and then started a business?
Yeah, which was a heck of a risk, no doubt. I mean, he had gotten tired of some things that were going on with his business, and because of his integrity and because of his core values, he decided he was going to make it on his own.
Well, what'd that do for you, your dad taking that kind of risk?
I saw a guy that applied his work ethic and was not going to be stopped. Although the risk was there, he believed in himself and he worked hard and he had established a tremendous amount of relationships in the industry that he was in, and he's done really well.
Do you take those kinds of risks now as a result of seeing your father?
It helps for sure. Risks are nothing but hard. You got to weigh the pros and cons, but assessing those risks, I think, are really important in any business and any leadership role.
John, you had mentioned that you and your brothers played a lot of competitive sports, and you actually took yours to the collegiate level, scholarship, playing basketball. Can you tell us a little bit about that environment? I guess that team environment and sort of like the big stage. How that molded you?
It's a great question, and I think it has very much. I mean, our core values at MMG are all around integrity, collaboration, and playing team sports. When I interview employees or potential employees, I can tell individual contributors that have played individual just by the way that they answer questions, the way they hold themselves. It's I. When you get into team sports, it's we, and I think that's framed me quite a bit.
Let's get back to the issue of risk here for a moment. Your dad took a big risk at 50, and you're a risk taker, calculated risk taker now. However, you sort of learned to do that as it related to some basketball decisions, isn't that right?
Yeah. I had an opportunity to go play in Europe, and at the time I was graduating, I had went to St. Peter's College, and they had the European tryouts, and there was an opportunity, which I did not take. And it was something that I've kicked myself now, just turning 49, it's something that I kick myself regularly. There was a trend at that time where if you didn't make an immediate impact, the teams over in Europe were not going to pay. And many times some of my friends that I knew I could play with were coming back and having to ask their parents to pick up that cost, to come back. And I shied away from it, and I took a job in Manhattan right out of school. And it's something now when I look at risk, I don't ever want to be regretful again.
But you're regretful of that.
I certainly am. I should have chased my passion. Basketball remains a passion. Gone through my second knee replacement. So it's played a big role in my life and continues to.
So in one of those cases, I suppose you could have pursued the basketball passion and known that that the job in Manhattan could be available anyway, but it would have been worth possibly pursuing that dream just to see where it could lead.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think, the other part, basketball, again, I think if I had to do it again, I probably would have got into coaching. So what I do now is I look at coaching and my role at the company as I'm the head coach. I've got an incredibly passionate, incredibly talented team. I think they're the role players in leadership. You can lead from any position in the company, but you need a head coach directing you.
So your number one quality as the head coach of your company is what?
I'd like to think it's integrity. I'd like to think it's work ethic. And I certainly think collaboration comes into it. So I've answered it. You've asked me for one. I've given you a couple, so forgive me.
John, you mentioned earlier that when you're interviewing people, you're looking for the we's versus the I's, the people that are team-oriented and team-focused versus the individual people that are just positioning themselves as the success. Can you talk a little more about that and the importance of that in building your company today? Because clearly you've built a great team.
Yeah, to me, you know, our industry, our world, I think any industry, and the world is getting a smaller place. I think the need to bring the best and the brightest services, there's more integration now with different companies. You know, being part of Omnicom, Omnicom is a world-class holding company for some of the best marketing firms and communication firms in the world. And if we were made up of a bunch of I players and just individual contributors, there'd be no collaboration. But our clients demand the best from each organization, and many times we're working not only inter-company, but we're working with other organizations as well. So that team mentality is critical for that.
You mentioned that everyone in your family, including yourself, is competitive. So how does your competitive fire manifest itself in running this company?
I've grown up in the sales role, coming in, worked for Hewlett-Packard as a salesman, as a sales manager. I've worked for a company called Integrated Systems Consulting Group as a director of sales as well. I think the competitiveness is just not wanting to lose. We know we're going to. It's not a perfect world. But, you know, between the team sports and the competitiveness, you focus, you put your time and effort, and you prepare, and you give it your best shot.
What does your dad think of your success?
I'm not sure he knows what I do. I think at one point there was a family party, he said I was a good BSer, which really hurt my feelings. I think he's proud of me. I think he's very proud of me. I'd like to think that, and he's told me that.
Excellent. What's the web address?
It is wegetpatients.com.
Give us that one more time. So make sure everybody gets it.
Sorry. Wegetpatients.com.
Thanks very much, John. We've been speaking with John Benbrook. John's the CEO and president of MMG. I'd like to thank my co-hosts, Phil Horegi of Sabre Systems and Brian Biondi of League Asset Corporation. Don't forget to visit our website, www.executiveleaders.com. Excuse me, that's www.executiveleadersradio.com to learn more about our executive leaders, and we will be right back after this important business spotlight.
Hi, this is Paul Smith from the Potomac Companies with your business spotlight, and joining us today is...
Jessica Druckmann.
Jessica, and what company are you with?
I'm with Concero.
And Jessica, what is Concero?
Concero is a company that puts together events for senior-level executives. They're intimate, invitation-only, and take place over the course of 2.5 days.
So are these like CEO getaways to Las Vegas kind of things?
Not exactly. We actually say to leave your golf clubs at home. They are serious events. We bring executives together to network with each other, forge new relationships, benchmark, learn new ideas to bring back to their organizations.
Are there specific type of target companies you work with?
We aim for Fortune 1000 companies, the larger organizations for the most part. Most of our events are function driven, so we put events together for general counsel, CFOs, CIOs, for example.
What do you enjoy most about your job?
What I enjoy most about my job is I have the opportunity to speak with and meet some of the most accomplished people. On top of that, when I'm at the events and meeting people and speaking with them and being in a room with executives all at the same level, sharing ideas and learning from each other, it's an amazing experience. And hearing from them that we've brought value to them, both to their organization and to enhance their career, is truly rewarding.
Jessica, how can someone reach you?
They can reach me at jdruckmann@concero.com. Our website is www.concero.com.
This is Paul with your Business Spotlight. We've been speaking with Jessica from Concero. Have a great day. Bye-bye.
We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. I'm your host, Mike Mannion. I am joined by my co-hosts, Phil Horegi of Sabre Systems and Brian Biondi of League Asset Corporation. And I'd like to introduce to you our next guest, a gentleman by the name of Sonny Kakar. Sonny is the founder, president, and CEO of a company called Sevatec. Welcome, Sonny, and tell us, what is Sevatec?
Hi, how are you? Thanks for having me. Sevatec is a management and IT consulting firm. We are focused on providing technical innovation to the federal government.
And the an example of some of your federal government agency clients would be who, Sonny?
Agencies like the Department of Homeland Security, Department of Labor, NASA, Department of State, so the various cabinet-level agencies, departments.
The average American citizen would be touched in what way by what your company does for the government?
Mm-hmm. I'll give you an example. We help develop systems, technology applications and systems that enable us to capture unemployment data. So when you hear on the radio that the unemployment rate is such and such, we help build the systems that collect that data from the states.
Interesting. How big or small is Savitech?
We're about a 150-employee organization.
Okay. And how did you twist their arm to give you a job there?
I don't have a boss there yet other than my wife. So you know, she twisted my arm to get out of the house and go do something productive. And so Savitech was born.
That means you're the founder, doesn't it?
Yes.
So why found a company?
You know, I cut my teeth in federal contracting through a company out of San Antonio, Texas, named Carter Technologies. And that, with my background, I'm an immigrant. I came here when I was 5 years old. I've been an entrepreneur my whole life. And I always wanted to build a firm. And when I had the right opportunity and I felt I had the right experience and capability, I founded Savitech.
So you jumped at the opportunity, or you waited very carefully, or you waited for a while?
No, I was very methodical. I did not just jump right into it. I felt like I needed to have the right experience. I knew that if I was going to go out there and help create jobs, I needed to be very experienced in doing that. If people were going to rely on me to make good decisions, I had to have enough experience under my belt in order to make those good decisions to build a firm.
Okay. You said that you're an immigrant. You don't sound like an immigrant, though.
Yeah, I was born in India. So I moved here when I was 5 years old, and so I started kindergarten here. So, yeah, I don't have an accent, but I certainly don't look like the typical American.
Meaning?
I am from the Sikh faith. I wear a turban. I've got a long, flowing beard, and so I really proudly wear my articles of faith.
Tell us a little bit about that. You proudly wear them. Tell us why, and tell us what that means to you.
Well, it means everything to me. So I think it's the basis of my belief system, and that's fairly basic. It's basically believe in a higher being in every action you do, work hard and honestly from the sweat of your brow, and share with others.
Yeah. So having a long flowing beard and wearing a turban is a symbol of that, or what exactly is the significance?
That's our identity. That was the identity that was given to us by our prophets. And essentially what it means is we are the protectors of the oppressed. We're the fighters for freedom. And that uniform that we were given 500 years ago is one we wear proudly today to represent what we stand for.
Yeah, very interesting. You said you came over here when you were 5 years old. Why did your family come over here?
My parents immigrated here primarily to give my sister and I an opportunity to live the American dream.
What was wrong with the Indian dream?
I don't think there's anything wrong with it, but I think that from my parents' vantage point, there was an opportunity in America that they had an opportunity to come out here and wanted to certainly give us that opportunity to get a better education. To live a life that may not be available in the Indian community.
Sonny, when we were in the green room, you had mentioned that your parents were very highly educated and you know, living probably a comfortable socioeconomic status, and then came to the United States and found that, you know, they had to work in a manual labor type of situation. Did that surprise them? And did that discourage them? I guess it didn't discourage them, but talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, you know, their education didn't quite translate here. So having a master's in the languages spoken in India didn't quite translate. My dad was an engineer in the telecom industry, but telecom industry here was much more advanced. When he came here, he had no option. He didn't have the option of going back to school and getting his education up to date, so he had to work whatever jobs he could find, and same with my mom.
So what was that like for you now? You arrived here as a five-year-old boy, and you're living whereabouts in this Washington area?
Yeah, we grew up in Wheaton, Maryland.
Okay.
And so I think my parents were a little bit taken aback about what they had to do to be successful here. And so they encouraged my sister and I to do what we can to kind of help the family
And what was that? I mean, I guess first off, was that an adjustment going from India to move into Wheaton, Maryland? And what was that like for you?
Well, it's a huge adjustment. When you don't speak the language and you have $7 in your pocket when they came, it's a huge adjustment. I think more courageous than any one of us, certainly not more than me, to go somewhere when you don't have Google and you're going to a new country where you don't speak the language and you want to make an entire life for yourself. And what they did that I think that was great was they jumped with both feet in. They didn't leave anything back in India to say I could go back. So they were fully committed when they came here, and they did whatever it took to make sure that the life here was it.
Yeah, even with the surprise that their education and their background didn't translate. I mean, once they were here, they were all in.
All in. There was no going back.
And they needed you and your sister to help support the family?
Yeah, I think that, you know, it's never really easy. And I was very committed right up front when I was a kid. When I was 11 years old, I wanted to, you know, my parents did not have money to buy my clothes, to give me the things that I was probably wanted. So not only did I have a paper route, I did landscaping. I had a landscaping business when I was 16. I put myself through college. But it was also to give back to our family just to make the day-to-day work.
You had mentioned in the green room, Sonny, that you looked different. People treated you as if you were different when you were young. What was that like? What did that feel like?
You know, I don't think it's different than what other people go through as well. Some people get made fun of for whatever reason. If it wasn't for this, I would have been made fun of or something else. It's really about really overcoming those obstacles in life and being very committed to your belief system. And I think that my faith and my identity really helped push me along.
To what degree did having the paper roots at 11 and having a landscape company at 16 impact your sense of identity?
Well, I associated hard work with my identity, always have been. Honest work, hard work, putting that full day in, doesn't matter how old you are. And so that hard work was basically very, very consistent with my belief system.
What's interesting about the belief system is you've become a U.S. government contractor. So do you find that as you've grown through the years, that the values that you grew up with are sort of like harmonious, you know, with the values of your customers and the missions of your customers?
Absolutely. I mean, seva actually is a word from my language, and it means commitment to lifelong service. And that service is my, as a servant leader, and not as a leader servant, but as a servant leader, how do I serve every employee within our firm, and how do we partner up to serve our client and add value and do it honestly, with integrity, and deliver beyond what they were expecting?
Sonny, you said you put yourself through college. Now, you mentioned the paper route. That certainly isn't going to do it. What kind of business did you have that supported putting you through college?
Landscaping, primarily. I had 4 or 5 employees, and we worked pretty hard throughout the summers and a few other months just to pay for tuition. Now, back then, I went to University of Maryland. It was a state school. It wasn't very, very expensive, but I was able to manage putting myself through college.
How did you learn how to run a business at age 16?
I think it was just intuition. It was something my dad was not a businessman, so it was I'm not sure how to answer the question other than I just learned it on the fly, and when I made mistakes, I learned from them and kept growing from that.
Well, it's interesting, growing up, other than your parents and the work ethic that they showed you, were there any, I'll say, business icons in the U.S. that you sort of like looked at? I mean, a lot of people growing up early may have looked at like a Bill Gates or Steve Jobs, you know, some of these pioneers. Anybody like that, or Donald Trump even?
I grew up, I'm class of 88 and from high school standpoint. I'm not sure I was had an icon that was from a business community. I had icons within my family, my parents being two of them, my uncles being others, and just that desire to make my family proud and make them never regret ever leaving India to come here.
Yeah, you had mentioned that in the green room, that you were keenly aware of the sacrifices your parents made to give you a better life. Was that pressure? Was it fuel to drive you? What was that?
All of the above. I think I recognize it a lot more now. We all live together, in fact. But I recognize it a lot more now. But I did even as a child. I knew that what life they gave up to come here and it was made very clear it was for to give a better life to their kids. And I've taken that on to make sure that, you know, they are now well taken care of and my kids in the future are contributing members to society.
How do your parents feel about your success, and do they feel like they made the right decision?
Yeah, well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, I think what they find joy in now is that I've got three kids. We all live together. They get a chance to really help me raise the kids and continue on the legacy that that they started.
Sonny, give us the web address for Sevatech, please.
It's www.sevatech.com.
Thanks very much, Sonny. We've been speaking with Sonny Kakar, founder, president, and CEO of Sevatech. I'd like to thank my co-hosts, Phil Horegi of Saber Systems and Brian Biondi of League Asset Corporation for helping me structure the interview. Don't forget to check us out on the web at www.executiveleadersradio.com to learn more about our executive leaders. And we will be right back at the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce after this important business spotlight. I'm Mike Mannion with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and this is your Business Spotlight. Today's guest is
Tim Keim.
And Tim, you're with whom?
Leadership Greater Washington.
And what is that?
We connect business leaders from business, government, nonprofit, get them collectively working together on issues facing Greater Washington.
Okay. There's a lot of organizations that sound like they do that. How is yours different?
Well, we focus on regional issues, focusing on making sure folks that work together should work together. We really believe in the power of relationships, so I'm kind of a matchmaker of folks who have influence, and we really kind of inspire their collaborative efforts.
So people or companies who would need that sort of help, give us some examples.
Well, anyone from a nonprofit CEO who's kind of siloed needs to connect with other folks, a business leader who has the ability to make change, or a government official needs to know more about what's going on, not just in his or her jurisdiction, but across Greater Washington.
Okay. Can you give us a success story?
Yeah, let me use the Fishing School. It is a nonprofit that helps folks in Northeast Washington focus on boys and girls getting after-school services. They were about ready to go under, but because their leader was in Leadership Greater Washington, got connected with business folks who transformed the organization, came in, did a business plan, did a marketing plan, communications plan, and now the organization has touched thousands more lives as a result.
Tim, what is your web address?
www.lgwdc.org.
We've been speaking with Tim Keim of Leadership Greater Washington. My name is Mike Mannion with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and that was your Business Spotlight. We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Mike Mannion. I'm joined by my co-host, Brian Biondi of League Asset Corporation. And it is my pleasure to introduce our next guest, a gentleman by the name of Jerry Halpin. Jerry is the founder, chairman, CEO, and president of an organization called West Group Properties. Welcome, Jerry. And what is West Group Properties?
West Group Properties now is a holder of some, 8 to 10 companies that we are terminating. And then we will terminate the properties company, hopefully, the end of this year.
And why would you want to do that?
Because we have sold all of our assets in the various West Group companies.
Got it. This company, West Group Companies, was founded when?
About 1962, I believe.
And obviously, in your title, you were the founder or one of the founders? Or the founder?
Well, I was the oldest founder and one of the founders, but I was also an owner, a principal owner.
And this is your life's work since 1962?
This plus about 40 other projects, but yes.
just 40 other projects,
yeah.
Okay. Why did you found a company 38 years ago?
Well, I had been working at a company called Atlantic Research that was a top secret company during the Cold War, developing solid fuel principally, and I handled all the business side of that company. And after 12 years, that company, as you know, the Cold War changed, mm-hmm. and with Russia and such, and Germany, and we decided to leave that company and start our own real estate company because I had started a lot of real estate projects, not real estate projects, but production and such for Atlantic Research across the U.S. and build a big Rossel missile rocket station manufacturing plant on Coastal Plaza in California, Southern Plaza.
Yes.
The beach down there. And we had a missile firing station in Green River, Utah, that fired down into White Sands. And
wow. So, and that was 38 years ago.
That was more than 38 years ago.
More than 38 years
that
ago.
That was more like from 19... I was attending Georgetown University Law School, and my wife had gone to work with two scientists, and I got invited to one of the scientists, who's Dr. Scurlock, his name was, originally from Texas, an MIT graduate, and he was a poker player, and we played poker. I beat him twice, and he said, anyone who beats me twice has to come work with me. So I did go to work with Atlantic Research, and I was head of all the business and construction and security, accounting, everything, illegal. I ended up leaving Georgetown University Law School early to go to work there, but I ended up with about eight attorneys working with
got
me.
Jerry, let me stop you there, because I got to ask, how old are you?
I'm 88.
Okay, and I'm guessing you could have retired a long time ago. Isn't that right?
That's correct.
Okay.
Probably 40 years ago, okay. 45 years ago.
So why are you still working and going strong, going hard at it?
I enjoy it, and I have a lot of challenges from it, but I have also the motto I say is retire and die. So I'd rather live than die, so I'm going to keep working until the day I'm ready to die, I think. So.
Really? So after you wind down completely West Group Properties, what's next for you?
Well, I told you, I meant to, when I said we had more like 40 projects, I meant to say that.
Okay.
I mean, we do have that. We have a possibility of solving global warming. We have, with some other friends, my youngest son and I run a number of projects in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. We own a lot of land there. We're looking at making a deal right as of this morning on 251 acres with a foundation to keep it open in perpetuity. But I just have projects to do. We're partners with the city of Mesquite, Nevada. We got a big project in Texas.
So let me stop you there.
I can go on. I only got two, four or five. You asked me about the 40.
Another 30 to go.
Yeah.
You know, what really strikes me is not so much that physically you're still going strong, but I think the fire still burns inside of you for working and for contributing. Where did that come from?
I think it came from my father, but the fact that I was young, a kid, when the first depression came along in 1932, was it? 29 to 32.
And you were how old?
I would have been 6 to 8 years old.
Do you remember much of that, how it felt?
I remember that, unluckily, my father lost his job. He was head of a sales agent for one of the big tobacco companies, never smoked in his life, but handled three states out of Scranton, Pennsylvania. But he lost his job, but we had a farm, and apple farm. I mentioned it before. It was 10 or 12 acres, and it had an apple tree, a currant bush, a cherry tree, a currant bush, an apple tree, a currant bush, over 10 or 12 acres, and that became a money producer for us in the Depression. And my father said if we helped him cut the trees or prune them and pick the fruit, we could sell it on the highway, Route 11 there between Scranton and Binghamton, and keep half of the money, and we could sell to the wealthy people in Scranton door to door, which we did. And my brothers would go do the selling, and I go do the delivering door to door. But we made money that way.
So Jerry, that was during the Depression,
yes,
that you had the apple stand. I'm assuming your father could have used your half of the money, yet he let you keep half of it. What did you do with your half of the money?
Well, he told us we had to buy our clothes from then on. And I mentioned to a number of people that that's resulted in one of my secretary heard that about 5 years ago. She says she now knows why I look the way I look. I've been buying my own clothes since I was more like 6 or 8 years old. So,
wow. Tell us about a major world event that really shaped your life? You had mentioned.
Well, it was a war. I was a teenager. I left a big job I had with RCA, producing radar things, and decided to go into the Marines. And turned out I got turned down because of my eyes, but they recommended me to the Navy for the Seabees, a new outfit formed. And I ended up out in the Pacific War for three and a half years, I think.
With the Navy?
With the Naval Seabees, invading the islands there from Kwajalein all the way up, well, Guam, and then luckily we dropped the right bomb at the right time. Some people feel differently about that. So
you were in high school. You were a teenager. You had a good job. You gave that up to volunteer to join the military. You served during the war. After that, you come out and you go to college?
Yes, I came out and went up. I applied into Harvard and Princeton, and not Princeton, Harvard and Pennsylvania, and Colgate, got admitted to all of them, but 6 months later, because there were so many people coming home from the war. And so my brother, who was with OSS overseas, spoke six languages, by the way. He's now deceased, but my oldest brother. But he was going up to Syracuse to get his doctorate, and he said, "Why don't you come with me?" So I did go up to Syracuse University, got admitted.
So, Jerry, your career is absolutely amazing. It's very, very impressive. And what I'm interested to know is you're now at Syracuse University. What's the next move for you? What makes you decide, and what were you thinking at that time that I want to go into business?
Well, I got into business when I was going to Syracuse University. I had a full-time job with Retail Credit, going out checking neighborhoods, and I hired two young ladies to do the typing and prepare what I brought back for Retail Credit. I bought, since I was in the Navy, I learned how to hammer and how to build things and survey, too. But
And what was the first business that you, after college, that you
started? Well, that was it right there, I think. And then I bought two old homes by the stadium in Syracuse University and turned them into boarding houses.
Jerry, you said that a decision point in your life was deciding whether to go into labor or to be a capitalist. Tell us what you meant by that.
Well, I was coming out of a class, a graduate class that I was admitted to, although I wasn't I was still an undergraduate. And we were talking about capitalism and such, and it occurred to me that capitalism, being a capitalist, would be more competitive for me than being a laborer. Now, there's nothing wrong with being a laborer. I think everybody in this room is probably a laborer, which is fine, and as long as you're happy and good health and good family, so be it. But I just thought it would be more competitive for me if I tried to get into capitalism and grow companies and be profitable.
Jerry, the thing in your life you are most proud of is what?
I think having been successful in business, mainly because of being associated with fine, capable people, staff, that I always counted them in as owners, and they receive. We have some secretaries and some gardeners who are millionaires or close to millionaires. Wow. We counted them in the business, and I always thought that's what we should do, and that's what we have done over the years, and it's made me very happy.
Yes.
Doing that. And
yes.
And then also we've been financially pretty successful, and I've helped a number of universities, three or four universities, and locally Shenandoah and some of the other ones that you're well aware of. And I'm currently involved in something I'm finding enjoyable, is helping the Seabees build their first big museum at Port Hueneme. That's where the Marines and the Seabees in World War II and still ship out of.
Yes.
It's north of L.A., and we've got a museum going to be dedicated this fall. But it's
fantastic.
I've helped that financially, and
fantastic.
Very nice.
Helped a number of other places financially. So.
Thank you, Jerry. We have been speaking with Jerry Halpin, founder, chairman, CEO, and president of an organization called West Group Properties, and that website is www.west-group.com. Again, www.west-group.com. Jerry Halpin, founder, chairman, CEO, president of West Group Properties. I'd like to thank my co-host, Brian Biondi of League Asset Corporation, for helping me structure the interview. Don't forget to check out our website, www.executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. And we will be right back from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce in just a moment after this important business spotlight. This is Mike Mannion of Sirius Interim Executive Solutions. This is your Business Spotlight. Today's guest is?
Frank McMillan.
And Frank, who are you with?
A company called PeopleShare.
PeopleShare. Well, what is that?
We're a full-service staffing company.
And what does full-service mean?
Well, we work with people for clerical, admin, light industrial. We're specialized in the legal side, call center staffing.
Given the economy, are people still using staffing companies right now?
Absolutely. We are growing tremendously right now.
So a typical customer for you would be who?
Lawyer's office, any call center, manufacturing facility that is growing or needs to hire some new individuals.
Yeah. Can you give us a success story?
Well, we have a lot of success stories. One of them is just a lot of the people that come into our office just don't interview well. And they just don't have the opportunity to get in to a location. And we give them that first step into the facility. So it kind of gives them a helping hand to get into a premier company. And then they see their work values and ethics. And then they hire them on as a full-time employee.
Why do you feel this is such important work to do?
Well, I really enjoy this because both sides of the customer, the company that I am recruiting for, and the employees that come in, both benefit tremendously from the efforts that I do. So it's very important.
Are there particular types of clients that you look for?
Light industrial and manufacturing are some very important clients, but call center work is very nice too.
Frank, would you give us your website, please?
It is PeopleShareWorks.com. That's www.peopleshareworks.com.
This is Mike Mannion with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and that was your Business Spotlight. We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Mike Mannion. I'm joined by my co-host, Brian Biondi of League Asset Corporation, and I'd like to introduce to you our next guest, Dr. Norris Krohn, Principal Founder, President, and CEO of University Research Foundation and Maryland Advanced Development Laboratory. May we call you Norris?
That's right.
Welcome, Norris. What is both University Research Foundation and Maryland Advanced Development Laboratory?
The University Research Foundation is a not-for-profit organization that was established with the cooperation of the University of Maryland in 1981. And it was established to pursue programs and research and development, mainly development activities, that were not possible for one reason or another for the university to do.
And they picked you, well, you're the founder. How did you convince them that this was a good idea and they ought to take a chance on you and this idea?
Well, I didn't really have to convince them because basically the reason we started it was that there was a project when I was associated with the Aeronautical Engineering Department and teaching courses at the University of Maryland. There was a project that was to be sponsored by the Federal Express Corporation and Fred Smith, the president of Federal Express, that we had kind of suggested they do, having to do with landing systems for landing airplanes. But the Federal Express Corporation wanted the work that was done to be held proprietary and be no publishing done, so the university was unable to follow to follow up on that because of the restriction against non-publishing of proprietary information.
Yes.
So then I, with cooperation from others in the university, decided to establish the University Research Foundation.
And that was when?
That was 1981.
1981. And you've been doing this ever since.
I've been doing it ever since.
Why haven't you gotten bored with this?
Because it's very much fun, very exciting, and very rewarding work. I work with a lot of people, a lot of different corporations. We've had sponsors, government as well as commercial sponsors, and of probably on the order of 40 or 50 different organizations.
What's fun about it?
Well, the development of new concepts and seeing the ability of principally, the two principal activities that we've been involved with have to do with aeronautical programs for many different sponsors, including NASA, that improve the air traffic control, as well as another principal area that we work in is with gunfire detection, and we've been involved in that going all the way back to the mid and early 1990s.
Well, you make it sound like you're a former fighter pilot or something.
It's funny you would ask that. I was a fighter pilot for 5 years and flew with the Air Defense Command, flew F-86s originally, and then F-102s.
Yeah, and I'm assuming that was pretty exciting.
Yeah, that was also fun.
Tell us more.
Well, I think flying fighter airplanes is probably the best sport in the world. It's equivalent on the ground to driving sport cars or maybe even racing at the Indianapolis 500 or one of the NASCAR races. It's just a lot of fun.
Never frightening.
Well, not very often. Occasionally.
Yeah. Take us back to your childhood. Where are you from before you became a fighter pilot?
Well, I grew up in Washington, D.C., and my father worked for the telephone company there. I was an only child, and I lived near a playground, so I would play with the other kids and got involved in sports and always loved sports, and I suppose that's why I always wanted to be a fighter pilot.
Because why?
Well, I found it very exhilarating. And fun.
You said you were lonely. When we spoke in the green room, you talked about being on the playground, and you said you were lonely. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I don't know what more there is to tell, except that going to the playground in those days, there were no organized sports. So you just meet other kids, and we'd choose up different sides and play, baseball during the season, football, baseball, or basketball. And that was kind of basis for why I always love sports and why I probably went into the engineering field.
So you're an only child. You mm-hmm. lived here. Did you have aunts and uncles and a lot of family outside of?
Not really. My mother came from Oklahoma and my father's family was from Pennsylvania. He actually had lived in Newport News. They met in church in Washington, and so consequently I had no other family, and since I was an only child, I had no other close relatives here.
So you lived on a playground. So you grew up in Washington, D.C. here. You come out of high school now, and then your next move is to go to college?
No, not exactly.
Wow.
I went to work for the telephone company for a year. And
why?
Well, because it was a job, and I could make money, and I bought a car. But during the time I worked for the telephone company, I decided that in order to advance myself and get involved in more interesting things in life, I better think about going to college, so I consider that a very valuable year. And luckily, we lived in Maryland at the time. My family had moved to Maryland, and we lived close to the university, and they had an ROTC unit there, and it was an Air Force ROTC, so it was perfect.
You know, I've heard that you use the word interesting a few times in this interview. Is that part of what drives you to make decisions?
Most definitely.
Well, wow, that was pretty emphatic. What do you mean?
Well, it's always just been fascinating to see things develop and see improvements. And being in the aeronautical field, as most everybody knows, has been great strides made over the years, even since I went to college.
Now, you were the founder of something pretty exciting in the aeronautical field, were you not?
Yeah, I think so.
Well, tell us what it is.
Well, the rest of that story is that when I went back to the University of Maryland, sent by the Air Force, I had a choice of either flying B-52s or going back for a PhD. I had gotten a master's degree in the Air Force before that. So they gave me the choice, and I took the PhD if I could go to Maryland, because I was living in Maryland at the time. And so That was what I did, and during the PhD program, I had to select a PhD thesis or dissertation, and I selected one, to my surprise, that had to do with proving out the ability to build a practical forward swept wing as opposed to an air swept wing that most airplanes have.
So in layman's terms, that means what?
Well, that means that aerodynamically, wings that are swept, this was discovered back right after the Second World War, But right after the Second World War, they discovered that airplanes that had swept wings, either forward or swept back, were much more efficient, could go a lot faster on less power and that sort of thing. F-swept wings were selected because forward-swept wings had a problem. And so for my PhD thesis, I decided to try to tackle that problem and see if I could solve it, which I was lucky enough to do. And I showed that you could build forward-swept wing. And then after that, went to the Advanced Research Projects Agency and told them what I had done, asked if they wanted to have an airplane. I suggested that we build an experimental airplane. And the result of that was the X-29, which is now in the Smithsonian Institute.
Have you seen it in the Smithsonian?
In the air and space, yeah.
What does it feel like to see something you created in a national museum?
Unbelievable. Unbelievable feeling, you know. I will say that I did have the idea originally, and when I went to DARPA, I became the program manager and then the office director of the Air Vehicle Technology Office. But I will say that I had a lot of help. And in getting that help, one thing I found that was really true is if you don't care who gets the credit, you can get a lot done.
Norris, what I'm curious about is here you've got this expertise in aerospace and, you know, a brilliant man, and you spend your time in research and working with the universities, and I'm wondering why you haven't, because I've got to assume that every major aerospace company has come and offered you a big job with a big check, and you've said no thank you, obviously. So tell us a little bit about that.
Well, there's a lot to that story, but I will say, start off with, I was a native of Washington. In the Air Force, I had been stationed in Texas a number of times, and in Ohio, and New York, and Alabama. And we had finally come back to Washington when I was stationed in the Pentagon after Air Command and Staff College. And I didn't want to leave Washington. My wife was from Washington. And so consequently, when I was offered jobs at, for example, Grumman or General Dynamics or Rockwell that were in California, Texas, and New York, I really didn't feel like moving. My wife didn't feel like moving. I had four kids at the time. And besides that, I thought this job, this organization that I had the opportunity of participating in founding would be very challenging and interesting. And for those reasons, I laid awake at night many times wondering if I was making the right decision. But right now, I'm very happy I did.
There's that interesting word again. Norris, give us the web address for each of these organizations.
The what? I'm sorry.
Give us the web address, your website address.
Oh, the website address. Yeah, the website is, my website is Krone, K-R-O-N-E, at URF, that's Uniform Romeo Foxtrot, URF.com.
Okay. We've been speaking with Dr. Norris Krone, Principal Founder, President, CEO of University Research Foundation and Maryland Advanced Development Laboratory. I'd like to thank all of my guests today. John Benbrook, CEO and President of MMG. Jerry Halpin, Founder, Chairman, CEO, and President of West Group Properties. Also, Sonny Kakar, Founder, President, and CEO of Sevatech. And, of course, most recently, Dr. Norris Krone, Principal Founder, President, CEO of University Research Foundation and Maryland Advanced Development Laboratory. I'd like to thank my co-hosts, Phil Horecki of Sabre Systems and Brian Biondi of League Asset Corporation, for helping me structure the interviews, hopefully giving you an interesting and educational experience. Most of all, I'd like to thank you, our listeners. If it were not for you, we would not even have a radio show. I'd like to encourage you to check out our website, www.executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. We have been broadcasting from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is Mike Mannion, your host. Have a great day. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to Executive Leaders Radio, the region's premier radio show highlighting local executive leaders. We hope you've enjoyed the show here on Federal News Radio. You can learn more about Executive Leaders Radio by visiting executiveleadersradio.com or tune in next time right here on Federal News Radio. That's executiveleadersradio.com.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWTFM HD2 Manassas, WTOPFM HD2 Washington. This is Federal News Radio, on the air at 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a sense of federal community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. Nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of Washington Nationals baseball, Washington Capitals hockey, the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, and American University Eagles basketball. Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m., the Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics, and your source for federal news now.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
For 45 years, people have relied on Village Green Apothecary to give them individualized nutrition, pharmacy, and healthy living products. Village Green will give you the kind of person-to-person help and attention that mass-market pharmacies have long ago forgotten. You can depend on us for knowledge, experience, product selection, and a smile. Visit Village Green in Bethesda at 5415 West Cedar Lane. Call us at 301-530-0800 or check out our website at myvillagegreen.com. We're here to